It's the Burt Cohen Show. The Burt Cohen Show, and we're talking about America, the nature of America, what we are. Some people say we are an exceptional nation. We are separate from all the others. And part of that pride and belief is in our freedom to talk about what we want, to read what we want, and to have freedom in the education community, at colleges and university. It's other countries that tell the teachers what to teach, right? That's not us. Well, there's something new on the scene calling itself, anyway, the Tea Party, who have really taken over the Republican Party. And it does seem, even though it hasn't made a lot of news, that they are really focusing on academic freedom, trying to assault academic freedom. We'll tell you about it with our guest, Paul Rosenberg. Thanks for being with us, Paul.
Glad to be here.
All right. Well, let me just tell the audience, Paul Rosenberg has been involved in political activism since the civil rights and anti-war movements of the 1960s. Hey, maybe we met on the streets back then. When he was in high school, he's written professionally since 1994, beginning with op-eds and book reviews, over 300 published, primarily for daily and weekly newspapers and for Publishers Weekly. He now serves as senior editor for Random Lengths News, an alternative bi-weekly in the Los Angeles Harbor area. His recent alternate story about the latest resurgence of McCarthyism is a follow-up to a 2007 story he did for Random Lengths about a similar resurgence during the Bush 2 era. That's George W. Bush, not George H.W. Bush, George 1 and George 2, dynasties in this country, I guess. But the latest incident has happened, and again, very few people know about it, in good old Wisconsin. And Wisconsin is an interesting place, a very interesting political history, generally pretty reliably liberal, progressive. Bob La Follette was a power to be reckoned with there in the governor's office and U.S. Senate many years ago. He was a Republican turned progressive. Joe McCarthy was from Wisconsin on the other side. Then we had Russ Feingold, the recently made to retire U.S. Senator. And now we have, of course, Governor Scott Walker, who is infamous for cracking down on unions and their ability to have collective bargaining. So it's always a hotbed of political activities. And the person who's the focus of your article is University of Wisconsin history professor William Cronin. Now, he's not a communist. I mean, Joe McCarthy.
Not at all.
No. Why has the right gone after him? And what exactly has been the assault on history professor William Cronin? What did he do?
Well, actually, it's pretty amazing because what he did was he started a blog, a personal blog, and the first post that he wrote about was about ALEC, a little-known organization, the American Legislative Exchange Council. And it's little-known by design. But people have written about it before. I've written about it. Others have written more than I have. And even, there was even a bit of an archive of following it that was active a little while ago. But no one's really drawn major attention to it that sort of caught the attention of a large mass of people until he started off his blog, which is called Scholar as Citizen, with a post that sort of, you know, shined a little light on what they were doing. This is an organization that coordinates legislation in the 50 states from a business conservative orientation. And they work informally together with state-level think tanks to do an awful lot of damage below the radar, because national media doesn't tend to focus on state-level legislation, and most of that legislation gets reported in a piecemeal fashion. And the fact that it's organized and that similar laws are being passed in different states is something that only rarely gets commented on. Right. And then the fact that this has happened over and over again almost never gets noticed. So all of this has been going on for quite some time. The reason it was so incendiary, I suppose, mm-hmm. is simply the serious position he had, the nature of the conflict that was ongoing, the fact that he put this post up on March 15th, so there was a lot of attention on Wisconsin at the time, and he got like 500,000 hits, which is sort of unheard of for a first-time blog post. So he really struck a nerve, and they noticed that they were being noticed. So they, you know, did what the right does so well, which is to attack the messenger. And they didn't have a lot to attack him with initially. So I mean, the initial form of it was to say, to themselves, well, this guy's up to something, so let's dig in and find some dirt on him, essentially. I mean, it was just sort of a fishing expedition. They had no reason to believe that he had done anything wrong. And in fact, when the university eventually complied with their open records request, they explicitly said that he had done nothing wrong. Hmm. But they asked for, you know, emails that he may have sent that had words in it like union, the names of the two public employee unions, the names of their presidents, the names of the legislators who were being targeted for recall. So basically, they were looking for evidence that he was involved in a political counterattack against the governor's program, and using those terms also just to get a look into anything he had written that they could then possibly gin up into a controversy or a smear, because as we know from many other examples, you don't have to do anything wrong to be portrayed as doing something wrong, and it's just much more convenient if you can attack somebody for something that is seemingly corrupt or dishonest or unseemly, that has nothing to do with the issues at hand, so that they don't have to discuss, having very unpopular positions. And for that purpose, you know, a fishing expedition
yes.
is ideal, because you never know what you can come up with, and if you come up with something good, it will be all about that, and you will, you know, never want to talk about anything else. So that's basically what they did, is they put in an open records request. And Cronin responded by saying, look, I support this kind of law, and of course I will comply, but it's really not a good idea to do this, because it has all kinds of damaging impacts that, you know, the Republican Party and really no one else should want to see happen, because it has a chilling effect on scholarship.
Absolutely.
It can, it can prevent people from being communicating about things that normally should be communicated about. One of the objections that he raised was the fact that there is a federal law that protects student privacy, and in fact, that law was authored in an amendment to the law back in the 70s by William F. Buckley's brother when he was a senator. So, yeah. I mean,
Jim.
You know, it's not just a right versus left thing, but, you know, a conservative attack that threatens privacy that's protected by a federal law that was initially authored by a conservative. So, you know, there was just a great deal of, a great deal more to the request than it might seem on its surface. And he wrote a very long, eloquent blog post about it, laying out his position about why it was a bad idea and why he hoped that they would simply withdraw the request.
Now, who made the request? Was it Alec, the American legislator?
No, it wasn't Alec. It was the state GOP.
So the state GOP.
We already have the evidence of that prank call about how, how responsive the governor is to, to the private money machine behind, the conservative movement, how open he is to outside influences while blasting, state workers for supposedly doing the same thing. So, it doesn't take a lot to surmise that, these are basically the same people wearing different hats that are doing all this stuff. And so
did they go after
exactly how it came about, in part because public universities have these openness requirements that a party does not have and that a group like Alec does not have. So when you have privately funded, privately organized groups attacking public groups, there's an asymmetry there because the private groups don't have to share what they're doing in nearly as open a manner as public organizations have to.
Oh, so that's interesting. We are talking with Paul Rosenberg about sort of a new McCarthyism through the internet, tapping into emails, so that the private organizations can have access to a public organization like a university. I wonder if it had been, did they get to, I don't know if the word tap is appropriate, it sort of seems like it. Did they tap Cronin's emails from the university or his personal stuff?
No. Well, actually what they were doing is they weren't tapping, but they made a request for all of the emails over a time period. So it was like archived emails.
Right, from the university though, right?
But it was from the university. However, as Cronin explained, he uses his university account in virtually everything he does because he is proud to be associated with the institution. Much of what he does reflects on it. He's the incoming president of the American Historical Association.
No kidding.
And it's certainly part of the nature of universities like that. Part of what they do is develop reputations which are earned by a lot of hard work. Much of it goes far beyond what's legally or contractually required of the teachers there.
Yeah.
And when someone like that advances to the top levels of their profession, it reflects very well on the university. It's part of what enables the university to turn around and attract even more students, teachers, and other resources. So, it's the kind of non-monetized contribution that that scholars have made to society, since time immemorial.
Absolutely.
And it's something that, of course, more traditional conservatives and ones that are still quite typical in Europe have long recognized and supported. So, this kind of attack that's happened, repeatedly by American conservatives is something that, it certainly has existed elsewhere, but usually in Europe, it's a province of far-right parties,
yes,
as opposed to establishment conservative party.
Well, that's the thing. I would think that a genuine conservative, as opposed to a radical right winger, would be aghast at this sort of thing because we fought in the Second World War against monolithic, authoritarian, repressive governments. You know, they were the bad guys who didn't let people talk, who shut down radio stations, as I remember from the 1950s commercials, as maybe you remember too. But here we have academic freedom, and I would think that's a very interesting point that Professor Cronin is headed to be head of the American Historical Association, but he's an American, and his blog was called Scholar as Citizen. I would think part of what a professor is supposed to do would be teaching people, especially a history professor, about participating in making history. That certainly was the...
Oh, definitely, and particularly in Wisconsin, which has
a
very active participatory
long history, sure. I mean,
what we saw in terms of the outpouring of union and pro-union protesters was, there's never been anything on that scale in Wisconsin, but it was very natural as an expression of the values of civic participation, values that they have. And Cronin, in particular, is known as someone who has taken an active role in the civic life of Wisconsin. He has been a frequent participant in public discussions. John Nichols,
writes for the Nation,
reporter for the Nation, a columnist, and also an associate editor of the Madison Capital Times. It's very a very active political reporter on the scene in Wisconsin. And he says, basically that he has shared the stage with Corona like more times than he can count because, he is very actively engaged, but he's a political independent.
Well, that's...
actively engaged in their politics, not from a partisan perspective, but as a representative of the good government, citizen-driven ethos of the state.
Yeah, science.
That's something that's very American, but is expressed with a particular intensity in Wisconsin, and it is the source of a number of leading developments in labor law that is spread throughout the country. So it has a long, long tradition, and he's very squarely right in the middle of it,
yes.
Which I think is one of the things that caught my attention is being so strikingly different from the way that McCarthyism has usually been focused in the past.
Right.
Usually, it threatens people in the center, but it usually threatens them indirectly. The people who are targeted are squeaky wheels. The term Ellen Schrecker, who's a historian of McCarthyism, used when I interviewed her back in 2007, and they go after people who are, more outrageous, on the fringe, not just on the fringe, but also who tend to be very demonstrative and very outspoken, and he's just none of those things.
Well, that's fascinating. It's certainly true about McCarthyism in the 50s that there were all these whispers and unsubstantiated allegations of being communist. But this guy Cronin, my understanding is, correct me if I'm wrong, he's really not even on the left. He's certainly no communist.
He's only on the left in the sense that the right is very much at war with these traditional American values. And, the center is the new left.
Well, they're trying to shift the center, that is for sure, with groups like No Labels to make the Democrats not defend anybody or any principles. We are talking on the Bert Cohen Show with Paul Rosenberg about kind of a new repression of academia. Now, he had every right to criticize Alec. I used to be, for 14 years, I was in the New Hampshire State Senate, and Alec absolutely had a presence there. This was a national organization which would bring boilerplate legislation and just fit it to any particular state. They were a hard right organization, not a conservative organization. And so is it the reality that Cronin was exposing or, you know, just bringing out the fact that Alec was involved in making some of the new laws in the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah, well, I think it was just simply the fact that he called attention to them at the time that he did, when, you know, when, and it went so completely against the narrative that they were trying to promote. They were trying to promote the narrative that this was, you know, just a necessary reform at the state level to, you know, fight back against Obamacare and, you know, national Democrats, and that then that the union protests that erupted were outsiders coming in to disrupt the normal functioning of the Wisconsin legislature. And, of course, that's completely upside down because,
right,
first
right.
off, you know, in the election, no mention of this kind of legislation was ever made. No hint of it was ever made. It was part of a national plan because, as was revealed in the fake Koch phone call, he was very aware of other Republican governors, you know, aligning themselves on a very similar set of programs, and you know, was anticipating them all following his lead. So, I mean, it was part of a national plan. I mean, it wasn't an accident that the you know, the head of the Wisconsin GOP had been promoted to be head of the Republican National Committee. It was no accident that for quite some time the GOP's, the RNC's homepage redirected to pages that were directly calling for people to support him. So, I mean, there was very, you know, it was very much a national focus of the Republican Party and, you know, and organizations associated with it. And at the same time, they were trying to portray it as, you know, all indigenous to Wisconsin. And what the shining the spotlight on Alec did was completely contradict this rhetoric. It was, you know, showing that this was something that was the result of long-time planning that involved a network of out-of-state organizations rather than something spontaneous coming, you know, out of Wisconsin itself. I think that was a big part of it, was simply that it was so completely disruptive of the narrative they were trying to put out. The fact that it got so much attention online so quickly. And, it was just the timing was right. The contrast with the message they were trying to put out was so stark. So it was just sort of a perfect storm.
In trying to repress academic freedom.
And it's telling that they tried to pass this off as just a routine public records request. And, I mean, in one sense, I'm sure it was. I mean, they probably regarded as a routine manner to try and dig up dirt on people who ask embarrassing questions.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to answer the questions.
Wow. Well, it makes me think about the case in Virginia where the attorney general was angry at somebody named Michael Mann, a climate scientist.
Yes, Attorney General Cuccinelli trying to... do something, whatever he can, to attack Michael Mann,
a climate scientist, researcher
into global warming, who doesn't even live or work in Virginia anymore. He's moved to Pennsylvania several years before Cuccinelli came into office. But Cuccinelli, was trying to dig into his past. And, you know, the justification for this was a so-called ClimateGate scandal, which was a complete non-scandal. Stolen emails were used to try and concoct a theory of a grand conspiracy that, you know, global warming wasn't real, but all this data was being manipulated by these nefarious scientists to make it appear that it was. And it's a completely bogus charge. Michael Mann, I guess the worst thing they have against him, and this is an example of what a fishing expedition could do. There was a place in one email in which he talked about a trick.
Right, which is a scientific.
And a trick in scientific parlance usually means something like, I don't know, I mean, if you've been in any had a class in math or science has probably heard a professor talk about it.
Sure.
And what it means is you got some kind of situation in which you got a dense amount of data or a complex set of equations or whatever, and there's a way in which you can take a different perspective that simplifies everything. And it may not be 100% the same thing, but it's like a close enough approximation to really get at the heart of the matter of what's going on. That's what a trick means to most scientists or mathematicians. Mm. It's just a very clever thing to do.
That
helps you get at the heart of something.
Yeah, that's.
But of course, that's not what a trick means to your ordinary citizens. They hear that, they think that they're being tricked. You know, like. You know, sold a new car that's actually been used by employees and had its odometer set back or something like that. You know?
Something dishonest, but that's not at all.
It's one thing to try and get mileage out of that falsely attacking someone in the media. People, do that all the time. What they don't do is go to state court and try and sue someone for fraud. And that's what Cuccinelli has done.
Wow.
He's taken something that, that dirty tricksters do all the time and tried to make it the basis of a lawsuit brought by the state of Virginia.
And even if this Professor Mann were to win the lawsuit, guess what? Lawyers charge a lot of money. And by the fact that one has to, could be subjected to a lawsuit, even if it is, absurd like this, it's still going to empty his pockets quite a bit. And that,
right.
I can imagine, may be the desired goal and have that as a chilling effect, even if somebody, so that now I can imagine professors thinking, oh, my, what did I say? Could I be sued for this? Could somebody interpret this? Because I don't have the money to sustain myself against a lawsuit, thus having the goal of a chilling effect to make professors toe the party line. Much like, the old Soviet party or other, authoritarian parties like that. Now, Professor, this Virginia Attorney General said that since it was a publicly funded university that Michael Mann defrauded the taxpayers. And that's an interesting angle. You talk about fishing expeditions.
Right.
Since it was...
Particularly because... most of his funding did not come from the state of Virginia. Most of his funding is federal funding. In fact, he was like responsible for bringing federal funds into the state of Virginia. So, even the theory that he's operating under is itself, very narrowly construed and misrepresentative of the overall situation. Plus, just basically, this is something that people on the right have been saying for a long time, which is another example of conservative projection. They're saying, all these people, they're just in it for the money. If a climate scientist were not investigating global warming, they would be, in an unemployment line somewhere.
Right.
Rather than studying something else about the nature of the climate system.
Yeah, he'd be bagging groceries somewhere.
This is just normally what scientists do. Scientists routinely have far more ideas about things that they would like to study than they could possibly do. This is the way that science works across the board. Generally what gets funded is only a small percentage of what could be investigated. So, it's not like people... in the sciences are lacking for ideas of things that are worth looking at.
Yeah.
They usually have a tremendous oversupply of them.
They're
facing this whole attack on a model of how science works that is just completely untrue.
We are talking about repression, assaults on academic freedom and what it really means. Now, what if... I'm not a university professor. I don't have any kids in college. What the heck do I care? Why should people care?
Basically because, our universities and colleges have had such a tremendous impact on the nature of our society from just basic research that has opened tremendous economic doorways to insights about what a good society is, what is humanly possible, to the role that they play in fostering the arts. I mean, it's just you look around at where there are universities and where there are not, and the difference is quite stark and quite striking. Universities are places that foster innovation, progress, and you talk about trickle down. That's where their real trickle down actually works.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not about making a lot of money. I mean, you know, the internet is a perfect example of this. Although the main line of it is usually drawn from defense spending and DARPA, which is, quite true.
Yeah.
At the same time, this actually all goes back much farther to that, and the support of technical and communication and the birth of the computer, all of this stuff has involved a tremendous amount of government spending that brought together military needs, educational and intellectual investigation, and the role of private enterprise by itself is just a total non-factor. I mean, the big companies like Hewlett-Packard that have sort of dominated the field for a long time, those sprung up directly out of the bosom of government projects that attracted people of very high intellect and, people who generally already had, strong reputations and established positions in various academic institutions.
You know, and research and development has clearly, I think, inarguably, brought great improvements to our society.
Mm-hmm.
And if we want to get off of our oil addiction, it's going to come from academic research. It's just no question about it. And having better battery technology. So looking at history, intellectuals at universities, the scholarly realm, sometimes does seem to be a threat. To whom is it a threat? And why is sharing knowledge a threat to certain particular political interests?
Well, I guess, that could be the topic for an entire show unto itself. But, I mean, there are several different things. One is simply that, private corporations want to monopolize as much as they can, as much knowledge, as much information, as much in the way of rights to intellectual property.
Right.
The tendency of universities is to do the exact opposite.
Uh-huh.
Like the model for the open source software movement, the ultimate open source is the university system of education, where knowledge is to be shared by all,
yeah,
and shared across civilizations. Even
uh-huh.
If it were not for the Islamic civilization's study of ancient Greece and Rome and preservation of many of their manuscripts, we would have been hard-pressed to ever have a Renaissance, because the Renaissance was spurred by the rediscovery of ancient civilization via authors from the Islamic civilization. And, of course, they didn't just preserve that information. They expanded upon it. The entire invention of algebra is basically an Islamic invention building on number theory and other branches of mathematics that had originated in ancient Greece. And that, of course, set the stage for the discovery of the calculus.
Well, no wonder.
All of that, of course, nobody ever made a dime off of the discovery of the calculus. All of that early work that was done on mathematics. Okay, well, I mean, people like sold books, right? But I mean, the basic ideas were unpatentable.
Well, and that's the thing about,
and that's what so much wealth is dependent upon, is ideas that are simply too broad to ever be patented.
And having control over information is extremely powerful. You know, if you're sharing information and making it accessible to people, that makes it a heck of a lot less profitable. And so I can see that that might be a real threat to the corporations that want to own and control all that knowledge.
So part of it really just is that. I mean, it's just a pecuniary interest. But then there's also just the threat that a greater understanding of, you know, will rob power from people who depend on ignorance.
Yes, that is true. And
I mean, you know, if you want to get groups fighting against each other, divide and conquer, the easiest way to do that is to play on their prejudices. And the last thing you want is people who are more educated, who can see through that, who can see that, you know, growing up second-generation Armenian-American is not all that different from growing up second-generation, Polish-Jewish-American or whatever.
Sure.
You know, that all of these stories have much more in common with each other than they have to differentiate themselves. Well, that's very dangerous knowledge to someone who wants to build a political career playing off ethnic groups or racial groups against one another.
Well, that's an interesting...
That's another reason that knowledge is threatening.
Well, and also, it does seem that, that the right wants to... They want to attack intellectual freedom, and for those particular reasons, and they're very, very good at doing that attack, very disciplined. I have a feeling it's in the nature of the right. An old friend of mine, as people have heard on the show before, Abby Hoffman, said the relationship between the right and the left is perfect. The right is sadistic, the left is masochistic.
Right.
So what is the people who are, you know, concerned about academic freedom? I haven't heard a lot from them. Is there a defense? Who is fighting back against this?
Well, part of the matter is that things are working the way that they're supposed to. That the that the University of Wisconsin, for example, defended Cronin pretty much along the same lines. I mentioned that he had written this blog post that laid out why he thought it was a bad idea for for the Republicans to make that request, and hoping that they would withdraw it. They didn't withdraw it, but then when the university responded, their response was basically that they did not produce everything that was asked for, but that they subjected it to a number of other criteria determining, you know, what was a legitimate request and what wasn't, that, followed a lot of the principles that Cronin himself had laid out. And some of it was just like common sense things, you know, like it said, you know, in their letter they said, we've made several assumptions based on the nature and context of your request. You asked that the university produce emails that contain the word union. We assume that you're using this word in the context of labor unions. We therefore are not producing numerous emails that contain unrelated terms, such as memorial union or European union.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was something that required judgment. But, and it was sensible. But in addition to being sensible, it reduced the fishing expedition potential, because it meant that a lot less emails would be looked at that maybe they could, you know, find something akin to the Michael Mann mention of using a trick, you know, something that was really a spurious matter that they could run with. So they got a lot less material from which they could cook up a phony scandal.
So the university,
so some of it was
community,
you know, common sense stuff like that. But also, I mean, they did exclude a good deal of material that they regarded as simply being, outside the scope of what was called for. Communications in terms of his position on various bodies that were like the American Historical Association, on the board of which he had been even before being elected president. So, they did a winnowing process in terms of what was a legitimate request. And they also explicitly said that none of the emails reviewed. The emails that we have reviewed contain absolutely no evidence of political motivation, contact from individuals outside normal academic channels, or inappropriate conduct on the part of Professor Cronin.
Well, that's
so
good.
A very proactive statement that he hadn't done anything wrong. Here are what you asked for, subject to normal common sense limitations. Oh, and by the way, there's nothing here.
Uh-huh.
And so
that's good. That's good to hear.
The university, which was entirely proper for them to do,
sure.
It's pretty much all the defense that organized defense that there has been, or that needs to be done in this as an isolated case.
Uh-huh.
But the problem is something you mentioned before about the chilling effect.
Yes,
particularly for someone just starting out.
True.
He's a tenured professor, one with an excellent reputation. Even if he was somehow forced to leave there, which it couldn't legally be done, but if it just became too much of a hassle, he could just go to another university, and they'd be very happy to have him.
Yeah.
But someone just starting out, and not just an untenured professor, or even just a graduate student, or someone considering going into the field, it's impossible to calculate the extent to which there can be a chilling effect on others, and how can you calculate the loss when someone who could have been making a tremendous contribution simply goes into another field. You'll never even know what you lost.
Wow. Yeah, and academics is, I suppose, it's like art, It's supposed to be something that challenges people. It's not supposed to be soothing necessarily. And there have been attempts to repress art and artists over the years, certainly. I mean, we've seen that in fascistic countries,
and
Stalinist countries. And now we have... I always thought that one of the goals of education, sending my kids to good schools, is to develop the ability to think critically. And it does seem that in and of itself may be a threat to the hard right. There is a lot of evidence that the Tea Party, right, the New Republican Party, they want to change education. They want to, and they're very clear on this. They want to shift what is accepted to be mainstream academics. And there's the example of Texas, where they shape the curricula amazingly there. What can you say about this, Paul Rosenberg?
Well, what's happening in Texas, I think, is just indicative of how, there's basically no limits to how far reaching they would be in rewriting the curriculum if they had the power to. Texas, they still have to sort of try to avoid stirring people up too much. So I mean, even though they have a relatively free hand there, they're still restricted by the mere fact that if they stir people up too much, that could actually mobilize the kind of opposition that could undermine what they're doing. So they push the envelope, but they don't do everything they want to do. But clearly, what they've shown they want to do is they want to rewrite history.
Yes.
They want to rewrite economics. They want to essentially substitute a fantasy story about how the world works and about how history works, and make that the common sense of the land. I mean, that's the ideal. And the best way to do things, of course, is to teach people to accept the reality that makes it impossible for them to challenge. You tell people a story about the way the world works that is so seamless that any kind of questioning of it seems crazy. And, of course, the scientific worldview is the exact opposite. The scientific worldview is that the world is full of things that we understand only imperfectly, that we understand perhaps the broad outlines of, but there are all kinds of details and cracks and crannies in which all kinds of unexpected things happen, and there's always a question about them. So if you have a world like that where there are always more questions to be asked, it's very different than a religious description of the world in which there are answers to everything, and of course many of them are simply not supposed to be known by man because we are inferior beings, and of course we can't understand these things, so don't ask.
Yeah, we had the all-powerful church in the Middle Ages, and then, amazingly enough, we got the printing press and could actually read the stuff for ourselves. So it sounds like they want to turn the clock back, 500 years or so, to have, this is the official doctrine, you may not vary from this. That's amazing to me. You talk about chilling. We are talking with Paul Rosenberg, who has written about the new right-wing assault on academic freedom. And something changed on September 11th, 2001. What does 9/11 have to do with this resurgence of attacks on academic freedom? There was, I understand, a non-controversial sounding group. This sounds pretty tame. The American Council of Trustees and Alumni.
Right.
Tell us all about this.
They were actually founded in the mid-90s, and Lynn Cheney and Joe Lieberman were two of the co-founders. And actually, what they existed for, they existed basically to try and move more of the control of higher education into the hands of wealthy alumni donors. And, you know, the history of higher education is basically that during the Renaissance, students would pool their funds and hire teachers to teach them, instead of being taught one-on-one, to teach them in small groups and lectures. And so, I mean, this is where the modern university, you know, has its roots.
Wow.
And so, I mean, it's very much driven by those who desire to learn. And, you know, the older model, of course, was, you know, through the education system that existed under the church, which was basically that they had a, you know, a system of understanding and explaining the world. And
they had a monopoly on the truth.
You know, to follow it. Yeah. And so these are two very different models.
Yeah.
Well, this was a very intentional effort to try and sort of reestablish the, you know, the model that the, you know, those who have the money call the shots and will determine what the university should and should not be doing. And
well, they put out, according, I read in your,
well, what happened in 2000
after 9/11
was, you know, they looked at it as a golden opportunity to bash their enemies, who are the, you know, the people who actually run the universities and value freedom and free thought and inquiry, and they put out this document that purported to be some kind of careful study that was actually just a mishmash that put together combined like slogans on signs at demonstrations with, you know, thoughtful comments from, you know, professors at critical forums and, you know, and complained about the fact that all these offerings were and efforts were being made to try and understand, you know, the roots of terrorism instead of just, you know, rallying and saying kill them all. You know? So, I mean, it was a very, you know, bizarre kind of attack, except, you know, if you can think back to what things were like in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, when people
great
were
fear.
Just completely disoriented, completely taken by surprise and bewildered. And so what they were doing is just taking advantage of that situation of bewilderment to try and finger-point at people who are not towing the line. And, of course, we all know what happened from that. Because we did not listen to people who had a deep knowledge of the Middle East, who did not have a long experience in how terrorism works and related issues, we got suckered into a quick overturning of the existing government of Afghanistan, which allowed bin Laden and his top and his top leadership to escape. So, you know, it was a failure, you know, quite simply. You know, the Afghanistan war began as a failure. And then quickly shifted to Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11 at all. In fact, you know, Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden were bitter ideological enemies.
Absolutely.
But, you know, because they had so successfully put people on the defensive who actually knew what they were talking about, it made it easy for us to do one foolish thing after another. And really, it's only now, in the last couple of months, with the, you know, with the democratic uprisings throughout Northern Africa and into you know, into the Arabian Peninsula, that we're actually seeing the underlying political dynamic that Al-Qaeda was trying to take advantage of is finally asserting itself. And we can see that, you know, what these people really wanted and the grievances that they had were not for something totally alien to us, but to something that we actually inspired.
Well, science and finding things out, it reminds me of that movie, A Few Good Men. You can't handle the truth. And that's what we're trying to talk about and what academics do, you know, without an agenda, try to find the truth. And the truth and the actual details of the reality on the ground in Vietnam, per se, happened to run way up against. It was sold to us. The war in Vietnam was sold to us as the free world versus the godless communistic monolithic empire. Whereas the reality was that the people of Vietnam had struggled against French domination and Japanese domination and wanted their own nation. But that didn't fit. That didn't fit.
They had struggled against Chinese domination.
Oh, yeah.
For like 1900 years, and we were sold the bill of goods that they were just a pawn of the communist Chinese.
Right.
When historically nothing could have been further from the truth.
Well, see, that's why academics are a danger, why scholarly inquiry is a danger, because it may get in the way of such things which are so profitable for the military-industrial complex.
And that's precisely part of the history of McCarthyism, because after the fall of nationalist China to the communists, there was this incredible house cleaning of all the people in the State Department who knew anything about that region. And that's what enabled us to get so totally screwed up in Vietnam, was that all these people who were quite familiar with the long history of China and the animosity there was between them and the Vietnamese, none of those people had jobs anymore because they'd all been driven out by McCarthyism.
Wow.
The thing is that kind of ignorance is self-reinforcing. If you don't know what you're doing, you get deeper into trouble, then you blame people who are trying to help by providing information that can avoid that. You demonize those people, you drive them out, you get deeper into trouble, you turn around and blame anyone else who speaks up, who's got deeper insight. And, you know, it's just a perpetuating cycle in which ignorance, you know, makes situations worse and worse and worse. And the worse it makes the situation, the more it demonizes those who would try to help.
And we can see that universities and academics in general is trying to get at facts. Science is trying to get at facts. And there's clearly this Republican war on science. And I did a show a number of months ago about beliefs trumping facts. When people have these beliefs and contrary facts come up against these beliefs, do they open up to the facts? No, they dig in more and defend their beliefs more aggressively. And so I can understand why, of course, they have to make war on academics and the university.
One thing to point out is that everyone has some of that tendency in them.
Oh, yes.
You know,
we all do.
What distinguishes conservatives is not that they are completely different from liberals, but that there's actually a structure and an organization and a political plan that capitalizes on those tendencies and tries to organize them for specific political goals. You know, even Albert Einstein, who's one of the greatest free thinkers in history, he could not accept the idea of indeterminacy. And so he rejected quantum mechanics. And, you know, all indications are that he was completely wrong to do so. But he was still so creative in his thinking that inadvertently he, one of his major efforts to try and show that quantum mechanics could not be right turned out to highlight some very counterintuitive results, which then turned out to actually be true. And so the thing is that even if you're a staunch, even if you staunchly resist ideas which you find
difficult, challenging, sure.
If you're a creative thinker, there can still be some good that comes out of that.
Well, for sure. And there's that that old saying, I don't know what the Latin is, but the truth shall make you free. And we all, you're right, we like to believe what we like to believe. And given that the truth shall make you free, this assault on academic freedom, what does that say about the nature of our country in 2011?
Well, the danger is, of course, that we're becoming more and more like the world of Europe that we sought to escape from when we were first established as a country, and even before that, when people left Europe to come here to settle. We are more and more dominated by establishment powers that leave less and less room for innovative thinking and for individuals to shape their own lives.
And that's quite a bit different.
It's the exact inverse of the narrative that the Tea Party seeks to promote. By the way, I mean, it's worth noting that the Tea Party's hatred of taxes, that doesn't derive from the Boston Tea Party.
No.
That derives from the Southern slaveholding classes, because they were the ones who hated the idea of taxing private enterprises
for
public
good.
Yeah. The slave owners didn't really need much in the way of public infrastructure. All they needed was enough of an armed force to keep slave rebellions in check. And that was about, the extent of their interest. And so they were always anti-tax, but the Northerners were very much pro-tax. They just wanted control over it. I mean, they are the ones who used taxes to build canals and then railroads and to develop the infrastructure for a continually growing and expanding economy.
One of the things I love in reading about American history is finding out all the stuff that happens to be true and just learning about that. And it's immensely freeing. We got to run, but if people are interested in following some of your writings, there must be some website to which you can point listeners.
Now, I'm starting to write for Alternet, but for a long time I wrote for Open Left, a website that just closed down February.
Uh-huh.
And so, the best way to do it is to Google my name and see what I've been up to lately.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Very, very interesting, very insightful, and disturbing at the same time. Paul Rosenberg, thanks so much for being with us on The Burt Cohen Show today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
All right. And hopefully we will keep respecting and appreciating the freedom of our teachers. Bells will ring.